The Vedanta by Frithjof Schwann. A chapter from Spiritual Perspectives and Human Facts, published by World Wisdom Books and read by Leslie Caravid for the Matheson Trust. Chapter 2. The conceptions of Ramanuja are contained in those of Shankara and are transcended by them. When Shankara sees in the localization and duration of sensory objects a direct and tangible manifestation of their unreality, he does not say, as Ramanuja seems to have believed, that they do not exist as objects, but he says that as existing objects they are unreal. Ramanuja affirms against Shankaracharya truths which the latter never denied on their own level. Ramanuja shows a tendency to put everything in a concrete form as a function of the created world, and this indeed corresponds both with the Vishnuite point of view and with the Western outlook, which shares the same perspective. The antagonism between Shankara and Nagarjuna is of the same order as that which opposes Ramanuja to Shankara, with this difference, however, that if Shankara rejects the doctrine of Nagarjuna, it is because the form of the latter corresponds, independently of its real content and of the spiritual virtuality it represents, to a more restricted perspective than that of the Vedanta. When, on the other hand, Ramanuja rejects the doctrine of Shankara, it is for the opposite reason. The perspective of Shankara goes beyond that of Ramanuja, not merely in respect of its form, but in respect of its very basis. In order really to understand Nagarjuna, or the Mahayana in general, one must before everything else take account of two facts. First, that Buddhism presents itself essentially as a spiritual method, and so subordinates everything to the point of view of method. And secondly, that this method is essentially one of negation. From this it follows, on the one hand, that metaphysical reality is considered with reference to method, that is, as state, and not as principle. And, on the other hand, that it is conceived in negative terms, nirvana, extinction, or shunya, the void. In Buddhist wisdom, affirmation has the same meaning and function as subjectivism, and hence ignorance in Hindu wisdom. To describe nirvana or shunya in positive terms would amount, in Vedantin language, to wishing to know the pure subject, the divine consciousness, atma, on the plane of objectivation itself, hence on the plane of ignorance. When Western people refer to something as being positive, they almost always think of manifestation, of the created, hence their preference for the perspective of Ramanuja and their mistake in attributing abstractions to Shankara, or to Plato. God is abstraction for the world because the world is abstraction in relation to God. It should be noted here that the word God does not and cannot admit of any restriction for the simple reason that God is all that is purely principial and that he is thus also, and a fortiori, beyond being. This one may not know or may deny. But one cannot deny that God is that which is supreme, and therefore also that which nothing can surpass. Now it is God who is real, not the world. People often believe that the content of a statement is false to the extent that the enunciation can be attacked by dialectics. Now, every statement, the content of which is not a fact that can be checked physically or rationally, that is, every transcendent truth, can be contradicted by arguments drawn from experience. Shankara never said that the inevitably human formulation of truth, bearing, for instance, on absolute consciousness, could not be attacked. He said that such formulations were intrinsically true and something that the reason alone could not verify. When the Advaitins say that consciousness has such and such a nature, and that the example of deep sleep shows it, that does not at all mean that they themselves had need of this example, or that they could be discomfited by a demonstration of the gaps it necessarily contains. Clearly, it is not because of a contrary aspect, but because of an analogy that one has recourse to an example. Contrary aspects do exist, but they are not relevant here. If we say that compared to an opaque body, any light is like the sun, the fact that this light has neither the form, nor the dimensions, nor the matter of the sun is absolutely without significance in this connection. Moreover, if the example differed in no way from the thing to be demonstrated, it would be not an example, but the thing itself. Intellectual intuition communicates a priori the reality of the absolute. Reasoning thought infers the absolute by starting from the relative. Thus, it does not proceed by intellectual intuition, though it does not inevitably exclude it. For philosophy, arguments have an absolute value. For intellectual intuition, their value is symbolical and provisional. Shankara did not construct a system. By this is meant an assemblage of concordant reasonings hierarchically arranged. It is true that one can always describe an orthodox doctrine as a system when comparing it to some system in nature, such as the solar system. In fact, a doctrine is in the nature of things an assemblage of ideas grouped harmoniously round a central idea from which they derive according to various dimensions. Shankara did not seek a solution of such and such a problem. He did not suffer from what he himself calls the disease of doubt. Shankara is like a colorless glass which allows the rays of light to pass through it intact, whereas Ramanuja might be compared to a colored glass which also transmits light, but imparts to it a certain tint. This is to say that Ramanuja's doctrine is also inspired and not invented. Sages are instruments for the crystallization of the pure light. They are anything but inventors of systems. It is intellection that determines everything. The mode of expression is dictated by the requirements of the particular traditional form. With philosophers, in the ordinary meaning of the word, the initiative comes from the human side, from mental restlessness, from doubt, from lack of contemplative quality. Their attitude is Promethean, not prophetic. God cannot change. Therefore, he cannot be the cause of a change as such. He is the cause of all things, and he is consequently the cause of what appears to us as change. But he is its cause not inasmuch as it is a change, but inasmuch as this apparent change, which for us is real, affirms an aspect of the immutable. Or again, simply to consider change as such, God is its cause only inasmuch as the change, or all change, expresses in the language of diversity the divine infinity, or all possibility. The world, inasmuch as it is subject to change, cannot have God for its cause. From the standpoint of its negative character, the world is not. On the other hand, change, insofar as it expresses infinity, not insofar as it negates immutability, must have God for its cause. And in this respect, the world exists, even though in the last analysis it is reducible to that cause itself. An effect, to the extent that it is ontologically positive, is not really distinct from its cause. It has sometimes been argued that the delivered sage, the Vidwan, having attained the state whence there is no return, into the karmic chain of samsaric existences, has passed beyond our ken and can consequently no longer speak or teach. Now, the Advaitins have never denied the double nature of the Vidwan. If Christianity were not the religion of the West, and if the twofold nature of Christ were not a dogma, no doubt the same philosophers who seek for contradictions in the Vedanta would declare the two natures of Christ to be incompatible, and would describe this dogma as a stumbling block. They would do the same as regards the Trinity. It is contradictory to maintain, in order to contest the reality of the absolute subject, that the intellective light is real only in respect of its projection on an external object, and that it thus has only a relative and extrinsic reality. A contrast can reveal the nature of something or bring out its value, but it cannot create that nature. It could not reveal a nature that did not exist. God is light in himself, and not because he illuminates our darkness. On the contrary, he illuminates the darkness because he is light in itself. He is love, not because he loves, but he loves because he is love. There is between the soul and Brahma both continuity and discontinuity at the same time, depending on the standpoint from which the relationship is viewed. Continuity from the point of view of the essential nature, which is consciousness, and discontinuity from the point of view of the actual nature, which is pure consciousness on the divine side, and objectivized consciousness on the human side. Objectivized in its very cosmic root and consequently darkened, limited, and divided by avidya, by ignorance. Hence it follows that the individual substance, even when empirically emptied of its objective content, is by no means freed thereby from the fundamental vice of objectivation, which can only be eliminated by knowledge. The being as such, that is to say, considered as a mode of objectivation, necessarily envisages the single consciousness, from which in reality he is not distinct, as external. The avatars adored God concurrently with their state of identity and on another plane, and therefore outside themselves. The great defect of the soul, the original sin, is not the accidental objectivation which causes a being to be distracted by one object or another, but rather the fundamental objectivation which makes this possible. Now, the fundamental objectivation is collective and hereditary. It belongs to the species and not to the will of the individual. Pseudo-Vedantist subjectivism, which in reality is solipsism, is incapable of taking stock of the objective homogeneity of the cosmic environment. It is Atma objectivized as Jivatma or Ahankara, which is the subject of mental objectivation. It is thus a subject already objectivized, secondary, and relative. When the individual empties his mind of all objects, he approaches Atma in a certain symbolical way, but the objectivation represented by the individual as such is not thereby abolished. Far from it. Spiritual realization is neither solipsism nor autosuggestion. Christ could say, "Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God." This signifies that everything necessarily participates in the essential attributes of relativity. Shankaracharya used such expressions as this: "I prostrate myself before Govinda, whose nature is supreme bliss." And Ramakrishna said, "In the absolute, I am not and you are not, and God, as personal God, is not. For the absolute is beyond all speech and thought. But so long as there still exists something outside myself, I must adore Brahma within the limits of my mind as something which is outside me." Direct analogy and inverse analogy. In the former case, a tree reflected in water will never be anything but a tree. In the latter, the reflected tree will always be upside down. Between God and the world, between the principle and manifestation, between the uncreate and the created, there is always, but in different respects, both direct analogy and inverse analogy. Thus, the ego is not only a reflection, but also a negation of the self. God can consequently be called the divine I by analogy with what is positive, conscious, and immortal in the human I. But he can also be called he in opposition to the negative, ignorant, and unreal aspects of the human I. The term the self expresses both the analogy and the opposition. To say that reality can never be attained by one who maintains the objective illusion is to forget that union depends not at all on some particular terminology, but on the fusion of two distinct elements, whether we call these subject and object or something else. It amounts in any case to replacing the objective illusion, which is normal since it is general, by a subjective illusion, which is abnormal and therefore far more dangerous. In order to be united to something, it is by no means necessary to start by pretending that one is not separate from it in any way, or in any respect, or, in short, that one does not exist. One must not replace intellection by a facile and blind conviction. It is useless to seek to realize that I am Brahma before understanding that I am not Brahma. It is useless to seek to realize that Brahma is my true self before understanding that Brahma is outside me. It is useless to seek to realize that Brahma is pure consciousness before understanding that Brahma is the Almighty Creator. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. The following hadith bears the same meaning. He who desires to meet Allah must first meet his Prophet. It is not possible to understand that the enunciation, I am not Brahma, is false before having understood that it is true. Similarly, it is not possible to understand that the enunciation Brahma is outside me is not exact before having understood that it is. And similarly again, it is not possible to understand that the enunciation Brahma is the Almighty Creator contains an error before having understood that it expresses a truth. If, in order to be able to speak of the self, one must have realized the self, how can one who has not realized it know that it must be realized in order to be able to speak of it? If only a sage can know what the self is, because he has himself realized it, how can his disciples know he has realized it and that he alone knows what the self is? Under these conditions, there would remain only absolute ignorance face to face with absolute knowledge, and there would be no possible contact with the self, no spiritual realization, and no difference between the intelligent man and the fool, or between truth and error. To attribute to knowledge a purely subjective and empirical background, which is at the same time absolute, amounts to the very negation of intellect, and consequently of intellection. It is also a negation of inspiration and of revelation. In other words, it amounts to a denial, first, of intelligence, then of its illumination by the self, and finally of the prophetic and law-giving manifestation of the self in a given world. It therefore means the destruction of tradition, for in these conditions the unicity and permanence of the Veda would remain inexplicable. Every realized being would write a new Veda and found a new religion. The Sanatana Dharma would be a concept devoid of meaning. Intellection, inspiration, revelation. These three realities are essential for man and for the human collectivity. They are distinct from one another, but none can be reduced simply to a question of realization. The realized man can have inspirations that are, as to their production, distinct from his state of knowledge. But he could not add one syllable to the Veda. There are very many instances of this. Thus Sri Ramana Maharshi said that his stanzas, Ulladunarpadu, or Sadvidya, came to him as if from outside. and he even described how they became fixed in his mind without the collaboration of his will. Moreover, inspirations may depend on a spiritual function, for instance, on that of a pontiff, just as they may also result from a mystical degree. This is directly connected with grace of state, the grace attaching to a function, authority, infallibility, and the help of the Holy Spirit. As for revelation, it is quite clear that the most perfect spiritual realization could not bring it about, although such realization is its sine qua non. As for intellection, it is an essential condition of the realization in question, for it alone can give to the human initiative its sufficient reason and its efficacy. This fundamental role of pure intelligence is an aspect of becoming what one is. Revelation is, in a certain sense, the intellection of the collectivity, or rather, it takes the place of that. For the collectivity as such, it is the only way of knowing. And it is for this reason that the avatara through whom the revelation is brought about must, in his normalizing perfection, incarnate the humanity which he both represents and illuminates. That is why the prayer of a saint is always a prayer of all and for all. To believe with certain neo-yogis that evolution will produce a superman who will differ from man as much as man differs from the animal or the animal from the vegetable is a case of not knowing what man is. Here is one more example of a pseudo-wisdom which deems itself vastly superior to the separatist religions, but which, in point of fact, shows itself more ignorant than the most elementary of catechisms. For the most elementary catechism does know what man is. It knows that by his qualities and as an autonomous world, he stands opposed to the other kingdoms of nature taken together. It knows that in one particular respect, that of spiritual possibilities, not that of animal nature, the difference between a monkey and a man is infinitely greater than that between a fly and a monkey. For man alone is able to leave the world. Man alone is able to return to God, and that is the reason why he cannot in any way be surpassed by a new earthly being. Among the beings of this earth, man is the central being. This is an absolute position. There cannot be a center more central than the center, if definitions have any meaning. This neo-yogism, like other similar movements, pretends that it can add an essential value to the wisdom of our ancestors. It believes that the religions are partial truths which it is called upon to stick together after hundreds or thousands of years of waiting and to crown with its own naive little system. It is far better to believe that the earth is a disk supported by a tortoise and flanked by four elephants than to believe, in the name of evolution, in the coming of some superhuman monster. A literal interpretation of cosmological symbols is, if not positively useful, at any rate harmless, whereas a scientific error, such as evolutionism, is neither literally nor symbolically true. The repercussions of its falsity are beyond calculation. The intellectual poverty of the Neo-Yogist movement provides an incontestable proof that there is no spirituality without orthodoxy. It is assuredly not by chance that all these movements are as if in league against the intelligence. Intelligence is replaced by a thinking that is feeble and vague instead of being logical, and dynamic instead of being contemplative. All these movements are characterized by an affectation of detachment in regard to pure doctrine. They hate its incorruptibility, for in their eyes this purity is dogmatism. They fail to understand that truth does not deny forms from the outside, but transcends them from within. Orthodoxy includes and guarantees incalculable values which man could not possibly draw out of himself. In Sri Ramana Maharshi, one meets again ancient and eternal India. The Vedantic truth, the truth of the Upanishads, is brought back to its simplest expression, but without any kind of betrayal. It is the simplicity inherent in the real, not the denial of that complexity which it likewise contains, nor the artificial and quite external simplification that springs from ignorance. That spiritual function, which can be described as action of presence, found in the Maharshi its most rigorous expression. Sri Ramana was, as it were, the incarnation in these latter days and in the face of the modern activist fever of what is primordial and incorruptible in India. He manifested the nobility of contemplative non-action in the face of an ethic of utilitarian agitation, and he showed the implacable beauty of pure truth in the face of passions, weaknesses, and betrayals. The great question, "Who am I?" appears, with him, as a concrete expression of a reality that is lived, if one may so put it, and this authenticity gives to each word of the sage a flavor of inimitable freshness, the flavor of truth when it is embodied in the most immediate way. The whole Vedanta is contained in the Maharshi's question, "Who am I?" The answer is the inexpressible.